You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Allison Kreiner-Brown, the Associate Director of Teaching for Change, an organization that provides teachers and parents with the tools to create schools where students learn to read, write, and change the world.
We believe that education and media are among the primary influences that shape the world we live in and how we engage in it. So schools have a very important role to play. They can either participate in changing society or they can preserve the inequities that exist.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe nidaps and nidabesks, aguanu. Hello, my friends, and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in beautiful, sunshiny Bunawabskeag territory. We are located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's yet another week and yet another great Love and Revolution radio show coming up for all of you listeners and for ourselves. We never know quite where our conversations are going to take us with our guests, but we found over time that diving into this new and uncharted territory, or even familiar territory, leads to some new understandings and vistas on what's going on in the world that we hadn't previously seen. This week's guest is Allison Kreiner-Brown, who is the Associate Director for an organization called Teaching for Change. Now, if you're anything like us listeners, your little anticipatory jingling vibes just got raised up high because we love this subject matter. She is also the Programs Director for Teaching for Change's Parent Organizing Project, a former middle school teacher and a parent, which we think is maybe one of the best recommendations. Allison, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on Love and Revolution Radio.
Allison, this is exciting. We have so many things that we are going to want to talk to you about, and I'm sure that we're not going to be able to fit them all in into the hour that we have scheduled for you. Teaching for Change is really exciting about, you know, building social justice networks that begin in the classroom. And I think it's interesting that this subject matter not only benefits the students, but it benefits the teachers because they have to be able to learn the material before they can teach them, because we can't teach what we don't know. So can you talk to us about the whole program of Teaching for Change, how it provides teachers and parents with the tools that they need to create schools where students actually learn to read, write, and change the world, which is from your website, which I love.
All right, yes, I'm happy to talk about that. So Teaching for Change, as you mentioned, our tagline is building social justice starting in the classroom. And it's actually better to understand our organization if you know a little bit about how we got started. So in the late 1980s, there were huge waves of Central Americans fleeing to this country, you know, talking about history repeating itself, and they were fleeing the violence in their countries that was sponsored by the U.S. government. And so what happened is you had families coming and their children started showing up in the public schools. So Teaching for Change actually started as a network of educators who had different committees around the United States who were trying to figure out, who are these students, where are they coming from, what's the political context, historical context, what is their culture. And so we started by producing resources in our earliest years, actually giving tours for teachers to go to Guatemala and El Salvador to learn about who these students were and what were the political realities, and then to create lessons and resources so that that could be included in the curriculum. So fast forward, our work now still looks very similar, except in addition to the resources around Central American history and culture, when you look at people of color and marginalized communities in this country, we're also marginalized from the textbooks. were also marginalized from the children's books and from literature, Black history gets relegated to a month, or sometimes it's in the sidebar, or it's usually just a few names who show up in the textbook. And the same goes for poor income Americans. The same goes for immigrants from other countries. Women tend to be marginalized and in many ways tokenized, and we really have this narrative of in this country that there were a few white, mostly all white men who really made change in this country, and you sprinkle that in with a few people of color and some women here and there, and that's how we got to where we are. And what we believe is that if you look back at history, you will see that really change in this country was driven by everyday people who were working together and fighting for what they thought this country should be and where it needs to go. And so our resources are about creating lessons. We have several publications. We have several websites, if people go to teachingforchange.org, that help K through 12, and we even have some early childhood materials, help teachers teach a more complex and thorough version of history that encourages students to rethink the world as it's being fed to them, to rethink their textbooks, to rethink the news media. And as you said, that is often a re-education process for the teachers as well. So that's what our resources are. We do trainings around our different books and publications. Again, many of our resources and lessons can be downloaded for free. We partner with Rethinking Schools on this Zen Education project named after Howard Zinn, and I'm happy to talk more about that as we move along in the show.
Well, you're the kind of teaching organization that I always wanted to encounter growing up, and we have mentioned on the show before, kind of our, Sherry and I both grew up in Maine, and just some of our differences in terms of the educations we received and the blank holes that were left out. So I'm very aware of what happens when you don't get Indigenous history or you don't get the history of marginalized people. It's not just that you're walking around half blinded with one of your eyes poked out. It's also that you miss, as you said, that the real narrative of how change occurs. And the result is, no matter who you are, what background you're from, you're left disempowered for lack of a story, lack of a narrative. Would you speak a little bit about how these curriculums, what effect they have on students as they grow up learning about how change actually happens? And what kind of a citizenry does that, or humanity does that grow coming out of that kind of curriculum shift?
Sure. So we believe that education and media are among the primary influences that shape the world we live in and how we engage in it. So schools have a very important role to play. They can either participate in changing society or they can preserve the inequities that exist. And so that's exactly what happens in our curriculum is our students of color, our Indigenous students, our LGBT students, students who are marginalized in other ways, don't see themselves, much less in the history, if not playing an active role. And so what do you expect then if they are going to come up and in this country? Public schools and public education is a critical part of our democracy. So we are not, you know, simply educating the next generation of workers. We are educating the next generation of citizens. And so to be able to critically look at this country, because, you know, this might be a conversation for another show, but in addition to people of color and marginalized communities, those who are white Americans are actually harmed by many of the systems that have been put in place to disenfranchise marginalized communities. And so really we're all hurt under these systems. And so in order to change that, we first have to be able to recognize it and think critically. And I think it's important to note that we're not saying that, you know, everyone has to view the world exactly through the lens, you know, that we view it. But what we're saying is the resources are missing for students to be able to piece together a critical and comprehensive view of history. And I'll give you one example of that. Speaking about our Indigenous communities, you know, in our history textbooks, every single history textbook in this country frames westward expansion, you know, moving forward. And if you're taking a really critical view through this multicultural education social justice framework, we say you could also call that the eastward invasion, because there were people who were living, you know, on these lands before Europeans came. And we have one of our lessons on the Zen Education Project, again, that we partner with Rethinking Schools to bring lessons that teach outside the textbook. That's what we want. There's a lot that's missing from our textbook and a lot that's missing from the media narrative. So one of the lessons that's still one of our most popular is we actually have students put Columbus on trial. So the activity is called The Trial of Columbus. It's a role play. and the students have to argue whether Columbus is guilty from different perspectives. So they have to take on, one group will take on the role of Christopher Columbus, one group will take on the role of Queen Isabella and Ferdinand, and they will argue from the viewpoint of the Spanish crown. One group will take on the role of the Taínos, who were the indigenous people who inhabited the island of what was then called Hispaniola, or what I guess was later called Hispaniola, where Columbus landed. And they also have to make the argument from the viewpoint of empire, the system of empire. And so that's where you want students to have the resources, and you need teachers to have the materials that will allow them to look at history as this complex set of narratives and stories, where in many cases we did have actual winners and losers. And so we need to look at how can we become a more just society. And that's where we believe education and public schools and public education really has to play an important role.
I think this is so critical because there aren't enough discussions about the tensions that exist within these nexus points of our intersectionality, that we all come here with our own stories to these discussions. So as a Native woman, Benawabskik woman, there was never a point within my education where we discussed the tension that exists between the indigenous peoples of this land and all others, that all others had this opportunity, in quotes, to elevate themselves against some other. And so the indigenous people were kind of on the bottom of that pile where all others had the opportunity to somehow distinguish themselves or elevate themselves above the indigenous peoples of this land, because everyone else that was here had some type of vested interest in the subjugation of indigenous people and the invasion or settling of the land here. And how do we navigate that now, hundreds of years later, to find a workable peace that we can actually move from to form something different going forward? That discussion is never had within the public education system or even within private education systems, and oftentimes not even in many liberal arts schools. There was a young woman at one of the local liberal arts colleges who told my ex-husband that he couldn't possibly be Passamaquoddy because she had read in a book that the Passamaquoddy were exterminated, that they no longer existed. You know, the Passamaquoddy is the biggest tribe in the state. And so when you're dealing with that lack of awareness, that lack of education, the tensions that exist there remain undefined. We don't understand them. We just know that there's something that's preventing us from coming together. When Rivera and I met, she wrote a poem about not knowing that I existed because she grew up in northern Maine and they never talked about the fact that there were 5 tribal communities here. And so it was a revelation for her to realize that I even still existed, because in the history books, all you hear about are the Navajo and the Sioux and the Iroquois. And so all of the other hundreds of tribes that exist here remain invisible. And so when you're dealing with these educational processes, how do you deal with that tension that exists between these different cultural groups, between people who have different reasons for being here? There are a lot of people whose reason for being here is wrought with peril. We talk about descendants of slaves, refugees, people coming here seeking asylum, that their entrance into this country was wrought with peril. Their experience is very different than those who came here seeking fortune. And so there's all of these different tensions that exist. And how do you find a way to navigate that and enter that into the discussion when you're working with these materials?
So 2 thoughts on that. So one is, actually, we believe, how do you navigate that? I mean, that is education. That's the world that we live in. That's the context for the United States, particularly today. So you can see the forces that have, or I guess the underlying tensions that we are seeing bubble to the surface in more visible ways now, that I think in more tangible ways for many people, have been there all along. And so that's one of the reasons why we believe the K-12 space, the classroom space, we say they need to be laboratories for democracy. We need to find ways to both learn about where these tensions come from, look at strategies for how can we have a just society in which everyone recognizes and honors differences. how do we move forward from our past in ways that can create justice for all communities, particularly those who, as you said, have come to this country and been able to participate at different levels and under different circumstances. So we believe that that is part of just what education needs to be in this country. As for how to address those tensions, this is where teachers need support. And so this is where teachers need high-quality lessons. They need high-quality books and learning. They need time to do their own reflective practice. There are more and more schools of education that are offering courses on multicultural education and even starting to explore what does it mean to teach for social justice. And so there are strategies that teachers can use, and they vary depending on the grade level that you are at. So teaching for social justice and addressing differences in the classroom in terms of where students' backgrounds, you know, looks very different at preschool and first grade than it does at 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And yet it should still be addressed, and there are ways to do that. And for an example of what it looks like at the youngest grades, our, you know, early childhood levels, there's a whole line of multicultural education called anti-bias teaching that really focuses at the early childhood level. And the idea is that students or children as young as 6 months are already starting to learn and shape their thoughts and reactions on race, gender, and other forms of identity. By the time children become 3 and 4 years old, they get into preschool, they head on to kindergarten, they've already absorbed years of stereotypes. They notice differences in skin tone and in complex. And so they're already trying to shape the world around them. And so the idea behind anti-bias education, in an oversimplified nutshell, is let's interrupt this from the beginning. Let's teach students how to both recognize what we have in common, where we have differences, and most importantly, how do we stand up and stand together when someone's being treated unfairly because of something about them. That's what it looks like, again, in an oversimplified nutshell, at the early childhood level. When you get to up through elementary, middle, and high school, well, that's, you know, every group that has come to this country has a complex history. And if you read about the formulation of whiteness, there are a lot of groups who were not white at different points in this country. So the Irish were not considered white. Italians were not considered white. And these are really critical points for us to examine and to look at what happened to these groups. Where were their similarities? Where were their differences? What are the lessons that we can learn from this? What's happening right now to Muslims in this country has happened to other groups and should not have been accepted then, should not be accepted now. Why are we repeating these lessons? You know, why are we going to continue to repeat what has happened in history? And a lot of what happens is a lot of our population, unfortunately, cannot recognize what is happening. And when we get back into narratives and stories, cannot recognize how or cannot value the story and the narrative of those who have been deemed the other.
That's actually one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is Teaching for Change had its origins in curriculum around the Latin and South American refugees and immigrants in the 1980s. And as you said, that cycle is repeating again, and the lessons have not been learned from my perspective in a very positive way. And so my question is, what today are the core lessons that you see as essential for justice, equality, respect, human dignity, the values that we hold as humanity, for shifting from our culture, which from my view is very much based on domination and exclusion, greed and separation, to those higher values that we profess to believe in?
Sure. So there's a great framework for this that comes from multicultural education. And one of the books that Teaching for Change published is called Beyond Heroes and Holidays. And it is the practical guide to K-12 anti-racist multicultural education and staff development. So if you go to our website, teachingforchange.org, that's one of the resources that we have. And in the introduction to that, we actually talk about what does it mean when we're talking about multicultural education, how do we actually approach this and to, you know, avoid the lessons of the past. And as you can imagine, there's no silver bullet, as there is not for many things in life. However, there are some critical components and critical questions that teachers and educators can use to guide them in this. So I'll share just a few examples. So multicultural education can be done in a number of different ways, but if we were looking at, let's say, a lesson that a teacher wanted to bring into the classroom, here are some questions that we might ask. Does the lesson draw on the knowledge and experience of the students? Does the lesson help reveal the diversity and complexity of the issues in the fields it addresses? Does it reinforce the idea that students have individual and collective agency and help develop that agency? Does it convey a possibility, a sense of possibility and hope? Does it challenge stereotypes and correct misinformation about people of color and other marginalized communities? Does it expose the historical and institutional roots of racism or other forms of oppression and its devastating impacts on both people of color and white people, the dominant group and the oppressed group? So those are some examples of questions that we can use to guide, you know, how we're shaping education for our young people. And depending on the lesson, the teacher, the context, one of the things that we believe is very critical to this role and that we see as a strength of teachers who do this work very well is they're very reflective on their practice, and they're looking for resources, and they're asking these questions, and they're learning with their students. So the teachers are not coming to this as experts. They're coming with a base of knowledge, but they're also exploring and learning with their students, and they're being facilitators and guides and learners themselves as they are teaching.
One of the things that's interested me on your website, well, just about everything interested me on your website, but one of the things that I found most relevant at the moment is the Zen Education Project, given that Arkansas is now trying to ban all Howard Zinn books and the people's history of the United States in particular. So I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the importance of bringing forward these more complete narratives of our history and as part of the process of educating people, because if we don't understand our history, then we don't know where we're going. We don't know how we got here. So can you talk a little bit about the Zen Education Project? And then, you know, maybe we can talk about some of the other projects that you have for teacher resources available right now.
Sure. The Zen Education Project, for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with Howard Zinn, Howard Zinn is known affectionately as the people's historian. And so he was a college history professor who wrote the book A People's History of the United States, which really was one of, if not the first book, that departed from this traditional narrative of, you know, we had Columbus who landed, and then George Washington came, then Abraham Lincoln, and then let's throw in Martin Luther King, and now here's how we've become this great country. And so what his book did is he essentially brought in the histories, again, these other angles and perspectives, looking at different points in U.S. history. And, you know, what's interesting is that some people, particularly right-wing, they find this dangerous. If you're going to depart from the traditional narrative of America as this scrappy young country that just became greater and greater and greater, some people find it dangerous to challenge that. And we absolutely think that students need to have the resources to do so. And we believe that it needs to be not just challenging for the sake of challenging, but if you take a look at history, it's very complex. Anyone who looks back at 2016 and 2017, the times we're in, you know, I tell people, I said, this might, you know, 50, 60 years from now, 100 years from now, the moment we're in will maybe be a paragraph in a history textbook, maybe a paragraph. And do you think that's going to do justice to all of the people, all of the perspectives, all of the stories that are going on here? And how, you know, who shapes that paragraph, and how is that going to affect not only how people look back at us, but what they learn from that and how they believe they should act going toward the future? And that's really what we're doing when we're talking particularly about history education. So we believe that the lessons need to bring in multiple perspectives, complex perspectives, and the voices who are missing. We also believe they need to be engaging. So on the Zen Education Project, we actually call them teaching activities, because they aren't just supposed to be, you know, read this and answer a few questions, but we want students to step into history. We want them to get a sense of what it's like to make these tough decisions, to take on the identities of people who lived in what was a different time, and start to explore and navigate some of the complex realities of those times that they're going to be able to explore and navigate the complex realities of our time. So the Zen Education Project has, I believe we are past 120 teaching activities. And if you're on our website, zenedproject.org or Zen Education Project, you can also get there from the Teaching for Change website. You can search for activities by time period. You can also search for activities by theme. So some of the themes include Asian American history, democracy and citizenship, environment and food. People don't necessarily think that, you know, when you look at the history of environmental justice, they don't connect that to social studies. Immigration, imperialism, labor, looking at different identity groups, Asian Americans, Latinos, African American, Native American history. And so these are teaching activities, lessons, our vetted resources that we believe help teachers, again, teach outside the textbook, bring in the missing narratives and voices, often which for the schools that we are working with here in D.C. and in many public schools across the country, you know, our marginalized students are the ones who are sitting in front of us in the classroom. They need to be able to learn about their own complex histories and narratives as well as those of people who are around them and those people who they may not have ever met. As you said earlier, there's actually a study that was done by, I want to say it was Debbie Reese of American Indians and Children's Literature. She at least links to it, I know, where someone did an analysis of textbooks used in high school classrooms, and Native Americans are only talked about in the past tense. They're only talked about in the past tense. And that is extremely problematic, you know, and allows us to look over people, and that's where that invisibility comes from. So we are bringing, you know, the invisible to the light. We're bringing the missing to the classroom, and we believe that is what's needed in this country of ours for democracy and for the next generation of citizens who will come up, again, with the goal of us being a more just society.
I think that's really critical to look at that invisibility factor, because what that does is it creates this cognitive dissonance for people when they're facing contemporary problems with that population of people. We've seen that happen recently with some of the indigenous rights issues that have cropped up in this country, where the policies and the legislation and the practices are moving back towards termination of tribal rights and tribal identity, even termination of tribal status. And so as we're engaging in this process of being able to understand where we've come from historically, understand how the language has been colonized, how the history has been colonized, to present this picture that is not accurate, it's helpful for us to be able to formulate where we are and where we want to go in the future. And without that, we have no hope of being able to figure that out. What is your most current focus for the work that you're doing? Is there a contemporary focus that you have right now in light of the things that are going on in the country?
Sure. So for the Zen Education Project in particular, we are actually in the early stages of launching a campaign around teaching reconstruction. One of the things that we were hearing constantly after the election in November, and particularly in the early days of the new administration, as you have the Justice Department who's no longer going to prioritize investigating police departments and following up on these complaints. There's open talks and policies and laws put in place to encourage, you know, they're calling it addressing voter fraud, although we know that we can look back in history and we can see there is absolute precedent that the voter ID laws and similar kinds of laws are meant to disenfranchise particular voters, namely African Americans, lower income voters who are from lower socioeconomic income. And so we're seeing a lot of history repeated already, but a lot of people said, oh my goodness, nothing like this has happened before. We've made so much progress since the modern civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and now that could be rolled back. And so, you know, people are looking for an example of when else in time did we come out of very, very dark moment in history to see people of color, women, others make significant progress, only for there to be a blowback. And so Reconstruction is actually that time period. So following the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, you had the enslaved people were free and were granted citizenship. And what happened is you had a lot of African Americans in the South who began building schools, began running for office, And in fact, you know, South Carolina and other Confederate states had black congressional representatives in the 1800s, post-Civil War. There was significant progress made. Businesses opened. Whole communities developed. Housing. And then what happened was, as you get to the turn of the century, approaching the 20th century in the 1900s, you had this large campaign which just started to roll things back.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. Nonviolence Minute, we're going to share some excerpts from a recent article by civil resistance researcher Erica Chenoweth on another end of the intersection of education, scholarship, and action. In a piece entitled When Engaged Scholarship Means Resistance, Erica Chenoweth wrote, "Engaged scholarship takes on a new and urgent meaning when engagement means resistance. It's a hard time for scholars to be neutral, even if they wanted to be. If you're a believer in fact, objectivity, intellectual freedom, scientific progress, radical critiques of power structures, designing sustainable systems in any real technical field, and/or the value of academic expertise in general, then you belong to a vilified group in the current American polity. Most political scientists have little formal training in engaged scholarship, the practice of doing scholarly work that matters for the real world and actively getting it out there. But unlike other more formal conceptions of engaged scholarship, there are few workshops or spaces where people can share wisdom and best practices about, say, how to be a clutch member of your neighborhood's resistance group. So, for those wanting to engage in this way, here are a few points to consider. Get to know what's already happening in your community. Don't duplicate efforts. You may be raring to start your own group, and sometimes this makes sense, but in a lot of communities it does not. In fact, there are probably dozens of existing community groups and grassroots organizations that have been toiling along for decades or years that have profound experience. Don't reinvent the wheel. Instead, find the existing group that speaks directly to your most pressing concerns and show up for them. Write down your ethical commitments and share them with some trusted friends for accountability. Check out some resources on how to be a good ally. Do not treat people like research subjects, unless they are research subjects. And you need to be clear about what you're doing. Talk like a normal person. If eliminating academic jargon is important in formal policymaking spaces, it's also important in your local group. Learn to talk like a normal person about stuff. The measure of rigor is not based on stringing together sophisticated terms in a sentence. It's based on clarity of thought. Speaking of which, be impeccable to your commitment to rigor. Do not succumb to the temptation to spread false news, rumors, and speculation. Be impeccable in your fact-checking, stick to credible sources, and get to the bottom of the stories that you share. Another tip is to bring what you've got to offer. If you're into crunching numbers, awesome! See if there's ways you can help count things that need to be counted. If you have substantive knowledge about certain dynamics in the current environment, awesome! See if you can support your community that way. The possibilities are endless. Feel free to get emotionally vulnerable. This isn't the most comfortable thing in the world for many of us, but one of the fastest ways to build trust in grassroots groups is to show people your heart. It can be scary, but you'll be okay. Leverage your university's resources. Do you have meeting space? Do you have convening authority? Do you have a deep pool of fellow faculty, students, and staff who want to dive into the conversation? By all means, offer these resources. Now is the time. Put into action at work the same basic principles that resistance is trying to create in the world. Also, wander over to a department you don't visit much. For example, if you're a social scientist, check out what's going on in the music department. You might find that folks over there are singing, playing, and dancing the resistance. It's a great time to reach out and connect with people who are not obvious collaborators. And lastly, take care of yourself. Already feeling burned out by the new demands on your energies? Take a break and do some things that fill you back up. These are just some of the tips and advice that Erica Chenoweth included in her recent article. We'll include a link to this full article in our show notes in our email and podcast site. And now let's return to speaking with Allison Kreiner Brown.
As you get to the turn of the century, approaching the 20th century in the 1900s, you had this large campaign which just started to roll things back. You had Jim Crow laws coming into place. You had poll taxes and literacy tests that began to disfranchise African Americans who had gained the vote. They had gained the vote post-Civil War. But when the federal government stopped reinforcing or providing support to ensure the freedoms and the civil liberties of African Americans, then we saw this massive rollback in the South, the rise of lynchings and other forms of oppression, and the returning of African Americans in particular to second-class citizenship. And so there is historical precedent for this. There were also still credible stories of resistance, of communities coming together, of communities working with allies. And really what happened is there was, you know, when we look at the modern civil rights movement, there was a long groundwork that was laid as Reconstruction ended and the repression of black and brown bodies, you know, became institutionalized in a different form, but institutionalized in the early 1900s, you know, you see the long organizing effort to roll that back. And really, we see all of history as a continuum. So we are just at another point, a continuum, where it's very much looking like there's going to be a rollback, not just for African-American communities, but for many communities of color. So this is a key moment in history that is often glossed over a bit in high school in particular. And so we believe that this actually needs to be at the forefront. Students need to learn about the progress that was made and how we continue to survive and thrive and work together in the face of enormous repression, working again towards that arc of justice. So reconstruction is a key area for us. We have just updated our Central America teaching website with new resources and went back and reshaped and polished some of the older resources that we had with some support from DC Public Schools. I didn't mention before, but one of our projects is actually a parent organizing project. So these same principles around working together as communities for justice and voice, we also apply to family engagements. So we have a parent organizing project based on a similar approach. And we are really, really trying to get more books into the hands of teachers. We have a number of recommended books. If you go to teachingforchange.org, you'll see our recommended reading list. So bring Howard Zinn's The People's History into the classroom, but also here are other books that we have vetted that don't reinforce stereotypes, that bring in many of these missing voices, particularly for middle grades and younger. And then we have one of the things that we're highlighting is our Resistance 101 lesson, which is a lesson that was designed for inauguration teach-ins, but it's a great kind of meet-and-greet activity where students can secondary students, so middle and high school students, can meet some people who across time and across different issue areas and backgrounds have worked and fought for justice and learn from people who have been organizers, because we believe that to make change, community organizing and working together is a key piece of that. So this is a lesson to help introduce students to some of that.
I think that's one of your projects that I was most excited about and actually did the extra work of downloading and looking through it when it came across my awareness through Peace and Justice, primarily nonviolence-related organizations, who were very excited to see this. And so, you know, I love that the Parent Organizing Project is broadening the work beyond the classroom. And just, I know from personal experience, and Sherry does too, being nonviolence and nonviolent action and organizing teachers and workshop leaders, facilitators, that when we don't know our history, we're not just missing out on understanding the complexity of the problems that we face, we're also missing out on the incredible solutions and strategies that have been employed in the past. One thing I run up against over and over again is people freaking out about how the current regime reminds them of the Nazi regime. And that leads them to think that the only way to stop it is with violence or war, where some of the most robust and interesting examples of nonviolent history occur in resistance to the Nazis, particularly in Denmark and Norway, as well as several other examples. And when we don't know that history, we are orphaned, in a way, from the long lineage and legacy of people who have really experimented and really taken some incredibly courageous risks to give us tools for our times. So it's so critically important. And one of the questions that I have for you about the work that you're doing is, where do you run up against blocks? So you mentioned that you work in a lot of marginalized communities, which is fantastic. And I'm also wondering what challenges you face around standardized curriculums, standardized tests, the kind of crunching down of teachers' agency, which is funny since you teach about agency, in really bringing up and highlighting curriculum. And are you concerned about the Betsy DeVos being the Secretary of Education and the whole trend towards privatization of the public schools?
All right, yes, there's a lot in there. Let me see if I can unpack that a little bit. So just really quickly, as you were speaking, one thing that was sparked that I wanted to share. So from our Resistance 101 lesson, one of the people who's in that lesson is Mary Harris. She was known as Mother Jones. So Mother Jones, who some people may recognize, there's an online media outlet called Mother Jones that does progressive journalism work. And Mother Jones is one of the role plays, or the people in this role play. And she was very, very active in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And she, you know, looking at the lessons from history today, one of the things that she was most known for was standing with and supporting striking coal workers. So when you looked in West Virginia, where the whole company, the mine company owned the whole town, and everyone lived in the house that was paid for by the coal company, and they had to, out of their wages came their rent, and then they had to go to the store, which was also owned by the coal company, and so how these communities were really repressed. And Mother Jones was a furious and a fierce organizer, and one of the founders of the IWW, the International Workers of the World. But when you look at, and this is a community where you're talking about, a largely white community with few people of color, and yet we're still dealing with the social and economic issues of who has power and who controls both means of production, what say do ordinary people have in the rights that they have and their ability to gainfully support themselves and their families. So that was one person I wanted to particularly mention. As far as roadblocks that we are seeing or that we come up against, what I tell people about Teaching for Change is there are teachers who across the country who look in their classrooms and they look at their students and look them in the eyes and they realize that the textbooks and the materials they have are just not adequate. It's not enough. It does not do justice to those students. And those teachers come to us. We are approaching 70,000 teachers enrolled at the Zen Education Project, and that is when I say who've signed up for the Zen Education Project, you can go to the website and you can browse for free as much as you like. And when you want to download a teaching activity, then we ask you for your email and ask you to tell us about yourself a little bit. So this 70,000, almost 70,000, are people who have visited the site and have downloaded materials to use in the classroom. So we've had countless more who've just come to the site in general, but we have thousands of teachers who are using just that particular resource across the country. Nevertheless, the resources from our other websites and our publications. So we have school districts who've come to us looking for kind of lessons and strategies. We do training and professional development. As far as Common Core, what that's essentially done that, from our perspective is there's teachers feel so much pressure to teach to the test, whether that's the Common Core tests and at the high school level, depending on the state, that can be the AP tests or, the SAT, ACT. And so what's happening is class time in general is just becoming more rigidly devoted to test taking and test preparation as opposed to critical thinking. And so that's really where we are seeing teachers who really are recognizing that teaching for social justice, teaching for equity, teaching outside the textbook contributes to all of that. We absolutely believe that multicultural education, one of the pillars of that is that it should instill academic excellence. So as students are looking at different perspectives, they should be learning critical thinking and reading and writing skills. They should be able to form arguments. All of the sort of tasks that they are asked to do on some of these tests, they should be able to perform them. So this isn't separate, you know, or just an add-on. This is part of education. And a lot of teachers recognize that and are making the effort to put that into their classrooms. Some of them have more support at the school or district level than others. And then, as you said, and you have, in case of this Arkansas legislator who's trying to keep any title by Howard Zinn out of the K-12 classroom, to which our response was, we said, well, you know what, any Arkansas teacher who wants a copy of A People's History or a Howard Zinn book, let us know, and we will send you one for free. And we thought we were going to ship out a couple hundred or so, and we've got a conference room full of books. We've had more than 700 requests come in just from the state of Arkansas alone for teachers when we reached out to our networks who said, yes, please send me a copy so I can use this. So we are seeing teachers who recognize that, again, teaching for social justice is not separate from a high-quality education. For so many of our students, not even classrooms where you have predominantly people of color, even in our classrooms where we have mostly white students or students who may seem homogenous, they need to learn about those who are part of their own citizenry. We are all citizens in this country, and so we need to learn from and about each other. So as far as Betsy DeVos, yes, when we get into the, you know, kind of stepping outside the classroom and looking at the privatization of education, the proliferation of charter schools, high-stakes testing, those are absolutely very, very real concerns and threats to public education. I'd like to revisit those perhaps on another day, because that's a different conversation. That does relate to the, you know, what happens in the classroom, but really it steps back out, you know, into what is the role of education in a democracy? Who are the voices who are at the table and shaping what students learn, and how we hold ourselves accountable and ensure that our students and our classrooms get the resources that they need. So that's certainly related to this, but I'm going to call that a conversation for another day.
So given the concerns that you've stated, my question was actually kind of in line with that, and maybe it's one that you won't want to answer today, but when we're looking at this real reduction of opportunity, I guess, or of materials, information, when we're looking at those who are seeking to restrict only to their own narrative and who are being placed in positions of power where they're able to make those determinations for everyone else, do you have any plans in place for the dissemination of information beyond the classroom? Because most of this is about materials that can be used in the classroom. Is there a way for people to access and to utilize and to employ the information that you're providing outside the classroom if they live in an area where there are restrictions being placed on what's available and what's being allowed in the classroom?
Sure. So there absolutely are, which is one of the great things about our resources being very accessible. So we know that our lessons have been used by youth groups for different faith-based organizations or summer camps. A lot of homeschooling parents use our resources. But I'll give you an example of kind of one campaign that we have that's still active that sort of touches on how people can interact with this if you're not teaching in the classroom. So we are part of a campaign called Step Up Scholastic. And so we are working with others who are looking at children's literature, children's books, and saying, Scholastic, you're not publishing as the largest publisher of children's titles. You're not publishing enough that feature characters of color as the protagonists and lead roles, and those that also allow children to see and reflect themselves. So it's not, we used to joke and say it's less than 10% of children's books each year put out usually have a characters of color. And we said, well, if you looked at the books that were published with African Americans, if you took out all the Martin Luther King Jr. books, then you'd have an even much smaller percentage. And now I think you could extend that and also say the Barack Obama books that are coming out for children. So we have a campaign. We were part of an outcry over a book that Scholastic had published called A Birthday Cake for George Washington, which displayed his, or which portrayed an African-American man who he owned named Hercules, who was a world-famous chef, actually. It was a world-famous chef while he was enslaved by George Washington's family. And so the book takes place as Hercules is preparing this birthday cake for George Washington. And they end the book happy and smiling. And George Washington, oh, thank you so much, Hercules. And, you know, Hercules is so happy. And on the back cover, they're all, you know, he's arm in arm with George Washington and has his daughter there with him. And the book, number one, has historical inaccuracies. And two, Hercules was his chef. And in the year in which this book is supposed to take place, it's exactly 1 year before Hercules ran away. So, and freed himself. He was not freed by George Washington. He freed himself. So the content of the book, both the pictures and the story, was extremely problematic because it suggested that Hercules and George Washington had this employer-employee-friendly relationship. This was an enslaved person who, you know, who was kept against his will. And again, a year later, he did free himself. And so there was a big public outcry about the book. And so that's what launched this campaign. And as part of this campaign, we asked teachers, parents, kids, who said, you know, go to your classroom library, your home library, go to the library at your, you know, your local library, and look at the books. And so we said, do an assessment of what's on your bookshelves. How many of your books have characters of color? How many have African Americans, Latinos, American Indians, Indigenous people? How many have girls and women as the lead characters? And what the feedback that we got back was a lot of bookshelves looked just abysmal when you look at representation on them. So we had students, parents, teachers, whole classrooms, churches, youth groups, again, faith-based communities, who were writing letters to Scholastic to say, we demand more. And so that's an example where you don't have to be, you know, the K-12 teacher to look at, well, what are the books that my nieces and nephews are reading? You know, how can I talk to someone who's working with young people about, you know, if you look at books as part of the media that they're getting, well, who are they reading about? Who are they not reading about? What's missing? So there are absolutely ways for people to utilize our resources, participate in our campaigns and the things that we believe are important. We do know that there are some groups who are doing active organizing who do use some of our lessons. So we have a lesson called The Color Line, which actually looks at what were some of the laws put in place to keep blacks, whites, and Native Americans separate in the early years of the United States, and then to start to kind of draw some parallels to today. So there absolutely are applications for our work outside of the classroom. Our mission is to provide resources for parents and teachers, so that's where our particular focus is, but we absolutely encourage when and wherever they can be used. Please do.
Well, I think even airing this conversation will spark people's ideas and thoughts, imaginations, innovations in terms of deeply reflecting on how we intersect with this need for a changing culture. We know that, you know, we are increasingly becoming a multicultural society, that issues around people of color, marginalized groups, class-based differences, religious differences are going to come into our lives more and more. And the question really is, do we have the skills in our society, culture, and our young people, our old people, to really do that? And I think one of the points I'm hearing from you is that the role of education in general is to prepare us for the world that we live in. And that's far more than answering multiple choice questions. It's also about the skills to meet people as human beings and to be a little aware and informed and educated about the vast systems, the complex systems that have brought us to this moment together. I want to remind the listeners, because yes, listeners, we are unfortunately getting down to the last few minutes of the show, even though I know you don't want it to end. I don't either. We are talking with Allison Kreiner-Brown, who is the Associate Director for Teaching for Change. She's the Programs Director for the Parent Organizing Project and a former middle school teacher, as well as a parent. Allison, what are some thoughts that you might have for the average listener tuning in today to go forth mulling on around these issues we've been discussing?
Oh, that's a great question. So for one thing, I would say head to our page, teachingforchange.org. I'd say sign up for our email list. We'll send you a cool email every once in a while about things that are going on and that you can, information, stories, lessons, books that you may not have heard about and that you're welcome to pass on and explore yourself. And to some of the other issues and things we've talked about today, I would also absolutely recommend that people check out Rethinking Schools. That's our partner on the Zen Education Project. They published two new books recently, which are just phenomenal. One is A People's Curriculum for the Earth, which is a book with different teaching activities, reflections for how teachers can teach for climate justice, from the elementary through high school levels. They also published a book, Rethinking Sexism, Gender, and Sexuality, all of, again, about how to bring LGBTQ students into the curriculum in meaningful and respectful ways and just reflections from teachers and students about what that means. So those are two books that I'm more than happy to plug, along with Teaching for Change's titles, Beyond Heroes and Holidays, Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. Again, at our website, teachingforchange.org, we have several websites that teachers and educators can go to download free resources. And then I will also encourage people to check out three organizations if you're interested in more so the education kind of policy and what are people feeling about what public education should look like. I have three recommendations. One is the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools. The second one is the National Opportunity to Learn campaign. And the third one is Journey for Justice. And if you search for those three organizations, we say here at Teaching for Change, our work falls into kind of three categories, so parent organizing, publications, and professional development. If we had a fourth P, it would be policy. So we tend to, you know, to be advocates for high-quality public education, for multicultural and social justice education. If you're interested in more of the policy, those are three recommendations that I would give. And then also talk to, as much as you have access to teachers and students, talk to them about what's going on in the classroom. A lot of people, our current Secretary of Education included, and as a prime example, are making decisions and have spent no time teaching in the classroom, much less going to public schools. So my advice to anyone who, you know, is interested in education is spend some time in public schools. Like, spend some time particularly with experienced teachers, because there are some phenomenal things that our teachers are doing, particularly when they get the support and the freedom to meet their students where they are.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for providing our listeners with all of this incredible information. And thank you for the work that you're doing. It's making a big difference. And we'll hopefully work toward creating the change that we're all hoping to change in the world. So we appreciate you.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you two and your listeners. Those of us who have been doing education work for all these years, we are in this fight. We are absolutely in this fight. And, you know, our young people are the ones who provide the most encouragement for us to continue. And they're worth it.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Allison Kreidner-Brown. And thanks to Sherry Mitchell for engaging in this wonderful conversation. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find this song and more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my co-host, Ms. Rivera-Sun, for helping me to bring these discussions to the airwaves each week. We find engaging guests, and we also provide some engaging discussion of our own. I enjoy all of the questions and the insight that Rivera brings to the show. If you enjoy the insight that I bring to the show, you can also check out my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution also now has its own Facebook page, so you can go over to Facebook, look up Love and Revolution Radio, and give us a like. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program that can be brought to your community. All you have to do is call your local radio station and ask them if they'll broadcast it. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera-Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera-Sun. Our guest today, Allison Kreidner-Brown, really challenged us to think about what role we're playing and what role education plays in shaping a culture, a citizenry, and a country that is more or less capable of working for the changes that we need. Their organization puts out tremendous amount of materials that are of use to everyone from teachers to students to parents to just your average citizen like myself. So, listeners, maybe you'll hop on over to the Teaching for Change website and learn something new about the subjects by the time we talk to you next week.